Hi, welcome to Off Script. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Today on the show, we're taking a look at One of Them Days, new buddy comedy inspired by the likes of Friday and Superbad, a little bit of Booksmart in there, starring Kiki Palmer and SZA, who I didn't actually know can act, and she can. She's kind of good. We'll talk about it in the review. We're going to take a look at Adolescence on Netflix, four-episode miniseries. Pretty serious stuff. I know we don't do a lot of TV on this show, but we've been playing around for the last few weeks, having a lot of success. Big YouTube success. Go check out the channel if you're not on it already. We're going to take a look at Y2K. This is the 2024 indie comedy, A24. SNL writer Kyle Mooney wrote and directed it. It's about a bunch of kids right at the turn of 1999 to 2000. They're all at a house party, and then all of their devices go haywire and hop up and start attacking them. A little bloody, a little goofy, and we'll get into it. We're going to look at some upcoming trailers, namely Megan 2.0, Tron, Ares, The Phoenician Scheme, that new Mission Impossible Final Reckoning trailer. We're gonna talk about it, tell you what we think. Before we get to all of it, normally we talk about what we've seen on this last week, but honestly, we've just been watching stuff for the show, watching Adolescence. So we're gonna jump right into news. Our first story this week: Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible: The Final Reckoning is launching at Cannes. Oh boy, this was supposed to come out just like 1 year after the last Mission Impossible movie. Some things got moved around. Not really sure why. I think Andy's got the inside scoop. Just gonna throw that at you, Andy. What's going on with Mission Impossible at Cannes?
So Cannes, for those who don't know, or listeners of the show will know, it's the big film festival in France where they premiere generally a lot of indie movies that might become Oscar eligible. That's where Anora premiered famously last year, and a lot of other Oscar contenders do. That's where The Substance premiered. So it's a big festival. It's not usually the type of place that you would premiere a Mission Impossible movie. It's not entering in competition, but it's a big movie nonetheless. And the important thing is that all the stars are going to be there. And this takes place on May 14th, so it's about a week before the movie actually comes out. So it's mostly a PR stunt to generate a lot of buzz, get stars on the red carpet with a bunch of other films that'll be coming out that'll be more, you know, independent minded. So it's a good move like that. And of course, people will get to see it. There's a lot of hype and excitement. Word on the street was that the previous Mission Impossible installment, Dead Reckoning, underperformed a little bit. And they went back and kind of, I think, reshot a few things, probably just added more action and excitement to it. And so that's what's happening. That's what we know so far.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting, I think, for Mission Impossible fans who, there are many, and they are rabid, let me tell you. I've met some people on the internet that believe every Mission Impossible movie is rock solid all the way through, all right, banger after banger. Me, I think the series is a little complicated. I have a little trouble keeping up with the last three or four and what was going on. It was a lot of double-crossing, triple-crossing. Fortunately, Andy knows more about it than me. And being that I'm not as into the series, it'd be easy to be cynical and say, oh my God, they're using Cannes out of competition for a PR stunt to promote the new Mission Impossible movie. That's super lame. And if it were somebody like Disney, maybe I'd feel that way. But I'm going to be honest, Mission Impossible, in a lot of ways, is doing things that many other films don't. They genuinely travel the world. They take like a year to shoot these things. Rebecca Ferguson was just doing an interview recently where she was saying she's not in so much just because they take up your whole schedule. Christopher McQuarrie and Tom Cruise are doing real stunts with like real experts and all of this crazy stuff. I mean, they're kind of a big deal. And in that way, they are a celebration of a big blockbuster in a way that they're not made so much anymore. Now it's a lot of green screen, right? Now it's a lot of, well, God, blockbusters. We'll talk about the Minecraft movie in a minute. Stick around for that. Mission Impossible is not that. It's something a bit more traditional, right? It harkens back to something older, and I think something a little bit more, I like to think, sincere. So you know what? They're going to do the last one out of competition. It can do big red carpet. Why not? Right? Why not? For the globetrotting franchise, it really means it. Fast and Furious wishes they could get around where Mission Impossible gets, right? Like, so they got the gas. Let them do it, I think, right? Like, get dead Tom Cruise out there. Celebrate the movies.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Other people that will show up, the movie also stars Hayley Atwell, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Isai Morales, Palm Clemente, Henry Cherney. And it's a little bit of a kind of an Avengers thing where there's going to be elements from all the Mission Impossible movies, but they do a good job of not making it feel like homework. Like, they're not going to make you watch all seven of before. I mean, the series spans almost 30 years at this point, and it's very different eras of filmmaking. The first three from 96 to like 2006 is one era of filmmaking, and then the next three films, 4, 5, and 6, are kind of a different one, and then the last two, which is one big movie, kind of is another one. So don't feel like you have to have seen them all or even seen one, I think Tom Cruise and company pride themselves on you just being able to, hey, this looks cool. I'm going to go in the theater and see it, and I'm going to understand enough to have a good time.
Also worth mentioning stars Severance newcomer Tramell Tillman. Going to be good. He makes that new trailer. And we're going to look at the trailer just after our review of Adolescence here. So stick around. We're going to talk about the Mission Impossible Final Reckoning trailer. A couple other stories, though, before we get to one of them days. They're making a Hershey movie, which is weird. Yeah, Hershey's chocolate movie is set with Mean Girls director Finn Wittrock and Alexander Daddario to star. This is an exclusive story from Variety. Up till now, when we're breaking it right here on the podcast to talk about it with y'all. What do you know about the Hershey movie, Andy?
So this news just dropped today. This is in the tradition of what we're calling a corporate biopic. I think of things like the BlackBerry movie or even like the Steve Jobs movie. It's almost a biography of a product or a corporation. This is going to take place in the early 1900s where the Hershey Company sets up a factory and school to help orphans. And I was like, this is all PR stuff. Like they're just trying to train workers for their company. That's all we know so far. It's not fooling anyone. Everyone has kind of been poking fun that this is like right out of the studio, the Apple TV Plus series, where Seth Rogen has to try and make the Kool-Aid movie. Like this is almost that exact thing come to life. It's corporate PR. I don't know who's interested in this or who's gonna see it. Could be a disaster, but it's got some big names attached.
I think it might be headed in the wrong direction from the jump. Because you're right. Like, this is going to be something seemingly corporate, a little like BlackBerry or... oh, God, I just had one in my head and I lost it. What I'd like it to be, like, what I would like this story to be is something like Wonka, right? You'd like it to be something creative and clever about, like, a chocolatier with a dream and a vision. Or maybe something like The Greatest Showman, right? Where Hugh Jackman plays P.T. Barnum. But it seems like they're going to take the spin of Greatest Showman, where P.T. Barnum was not a bad dude and like gave jobs to people. And what a good guy, like an entrepreneur, right? Like it seems like that's going to be the angle with the Hershey movie with some of this press release. You're right. They mentioned a school that they built and how in the last 20 years before his death, Milton Hershey transferred all of his money to the Milton Hershey School. Because he's just such a good, like, sure, maybe that's part of the story. I don't know. And learning about the Hershey School is going to sell the movie. But like, it just seems a little heartless. It seems a little toothless, I should say. Not heartless. You're going to have to show me the heart, I guess, in the trailer. But I don't know. Any other thoughts on the Hershey movie before we talk about the Minecraft mess at the theaters this weekend?
I mean, you're going to have to really sell the Hershey movie at some sort of strong and weird angle, because it's just like, I mean, yes, it's a recognizable brand, but it's not like a beloved thing. It's you might as well make the Snickers movie. Like, it's indistinguishable.
Yeah, I've read more about how Hershey is like tragically terrible compared to other chocolate tiers around the country and Godiva and God knows what. Like, it seems like the rest of the world doesn't actually like it that much. Maybe I'm wrong. We'll find out when the Hershey movie comes out. I'm sure 2026. Yeah, release is planned for 2026. Love it. Go ahead.
I was going to say a fictional approach might be better. In some way, like something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, something where you are incorporating the brand, but it's not like a biopic because there is no story here, really.
Yeah, right. Seems like it's going to be a little dry and it's like a guy wants to make a chocolate company. All right, we got to talk about the Minecraft movie. I see a lesser show would have opened with this in the news, but not us. That's not what we're doing here on Off-Script Film Review. We save the goods for last. The box office. A Minecraft movie strikes gold with an incredible $163 million U.S. launch, $313 million globally opening weekend. Insane W for Warner Brothers. Like, their studio heads are doing a victory lap. Andy, who could have predicted the worst-looking movie of the year, has made more money than anything else?
In the great words of Samuel Goldwyn of MGM fame, no one knows anyone in this business, and including us. We both, even the experts and us on this show, did not predict good numbers for this. It was, they predicted it would make somewhere between 50 and 60 million domestically, ended up making triple that and hitting 300 million globally. It's going to be a $1 billion movie. And we couldn't have been more wrong. And it's been a hit with the kids, with the Gen Alpha. Young Gen Alpha generation, and probably bleeds into Gen Z. And it's a real interesting situation where I was listening on a different podcast where they were saying maybe the millennial time in the theater is over, because we've been getting almost 25 years of millennial targeted content, and maybe that's, we've overstayed our welcome a little bit. And this is kind of the first breath of fresh air for a younger generation and their content and their IP and things that aren't Marvel and comic book movies and Star Wars. Is something different that, you know, kids grew up with in around in the early 2010s when Minecraft first came out. So it's been a huge hit, big surprise. People don't know what to do, but it's a big win for Warner Brothers and for theaters. And we're always glad when a movie does well, even if it's something that's not qualitatively great.
Yeah, from what we've heard, it's a party in every movie theater that's running it. People have compared it to like Rocky Horror, right? Kids freaking out and throwing popcorn and quoting along and jumping at the chance to meme on everything that's going on with it. Great time at the movies. I feel for every theater employee that has to scoop up like mountains of popcorn and buckets of soda off the floor between every show. Dude, I did that for a couple years in high school. It was a thankless job, let me tell you. I saw a video of some kids getting arrested for being too rowdy. The AMC is putting up signs nationwide that are like, no stunting in the Minecraft theaters, like chill out. I don't know. Like, I guess I'm glad people are having a good time. I'd love to dunk on it and say it's like, I don't know, people should chill out. But like, dude, I remember working like the Twilight premieres and they weren't much better, dog. Like, people just go for some stuff. Some stuff is fun to celebrate in a way that's physical and visceral that, yeah, isn't really acceptable theater etiquette. But you know what? If the whole theater's doing it, people jump up and have a good time. AMC makes their money. It's worth it, I guess. I don't get it. I kind of thought the movie looked terrible from Jump Street. I'm not really interested in checking it out. But good God, Warner Brothers is raking in the dough. They're going to make like six more of these, right? Where they called it a Minecraft movie. And they said in interviews, because they wanted to leave the door to make more. Mission accomplished, right? Like, they probably already greenlit four of these things.
Yeah, it's absolutely going to turn into some sort of spinoff series. And I played a fair amount of Minecraft back in my day. But I don't recognize half the jokes, and I probably wouldn't recognize the game right now. But I always think it's good when kids are having fun in the theater. That means they're more likely to come back. And frankly, adults aren't going to the theaters. Like, we've been talking about, all the numbers have been bad basically all spring since the winter. Brave New World was the only movie to kind of make a little bit of money, and even that, it was just kind of broke even, barely. So like, you can't get upset that Hollywood isn't making, you know, more adult or better movies when adults aren't going to them. And now you make a kids movie and parents and kids and families are going out, and that's where the money is. So,
yeah, that's it. All right. Well, we should move on. I'd love to get on here and wax about how like Minecraft seems like a bad movie making a bunch of money, and like cool, good movies don't make any money. But like, boy, that makes me sound more out of touch than reality than anything else I could say on this podcast. So I'm just going to leave it. I think, like, you know what? It's an anomaly that I don't understand. Maybe I'm too old. Maybe I'm just an old man shouting at clouds. Minecraft movie, killing it. $1 billion feature. Yeah, that's it. We should move on to our first review of the episode, I think. Andy's going to be taking the summary on this one. So, excited to talk about it. This came out this year, right, in January, and we missed it. And now we're finally getting around to seeing it. So, I'll get out of his way. Andy, please take it away.
One of Them Days. So this is a new comedy by director Lawrence Lamont, starring Kiki Palmer and SZA as Drew and Alyssa, who are roommates living in L.A. A little hard on times. Their rent is due, but they find out that Alyssa's boyfriend has taken their rent money and invested in dupe T-shirts or some sort of scheme. And so they're on a quest to pay the rent. They have to go on an adventure. Drew's got a job interview to try and make. They got to get money together for the rent, or they'll get evicted by the end of the day. It's a very kind of Friday-esque adventure in LA. Lots of goofiness, lots of fun. We learn lessons along the way, and that's kind of where it started. It's very basic. This kind of movie used to be made a lot more. You know, we got to do XYZ to pay for the rent or to save the whatever. The kind of movie that hasn't been made in a long time. But I think a lot of this works. And Zach, what do you think?
I like One of Them Days. I think it's a great time at home. I think if I had watched it in theaters, I probably would have been not as into it, because it does end up dragging in the second half. They do this great thing right at the jump, where Drew's like, "Hey, we got to get rent money. We got to figure this out." They lose the rent money for one silly reason or another, involving a goofy boyfriend character, and like it sets a timer at the start. It's like ba-doom, puts it on screen a title card, like 9 hours till rent is due, right? And then as they like go through these funny happenstances throughout the day, goofy situations, gotta outrun a cop, gotta find the boyfriend who's got the money and figure out a stupid scheme, maybe we could try to donate blood, like our day moves forward. But then, like, for one reason or another, they kind of move away from doing that, and it sets the pace off real weird in the last bit and ends up feeling a lot longer than, like, 90 minutes. Kiki Palmer's a lot of fun. Sis is good, dude. She probably needs to do more. She's not a bad first entry. One of them days. Let's talk about it. Where do you want to jump in here?
Let's start with performances. Kiki Palmer's always hilarious. She was, of course, in Jordan Peele's Nope. And she can be seen all around Hollywood. She does a lot of red carpet stuff. She's always a joy. And her character, Drew, is kind of the more buttoned up, more responsible character. She has a job at some sort of restaurant, and she's hoping to move up into management. She has this interview at the end of the day that she's really worried about and wants to make a good impression. She's just like a joke a minute. Her facial expressions, everything's just a lot of fun. Her delivery is like, she's always a joy no matter what she's in. SZA, who is known more for as a rap and music artist, again, her first feature does really well. A lot of times people forget that musicians or musical artists like this, they have a lot of stage presence and a lot of kind of performance experience. So it's a matter of just kind of transferring it to the screen. Her character is a little bit more laid back. She doesn't really have a job. She's got this boyfriend that's kind of bumming off her as well in a lot of funny moments. But she's an artiste. She paints a lot. She just kind of goes with the vibes. And she's like, no, we're going to figure it out. It's going to be okay. We have a couple of cameo appearances by Lil Rel Howery, who you might recognize from Get Out as a funny character there. The great Cat Williams makes a couple of appearances, who takes acting very, very seriously. And he only has a few scenes, but he's very funny in all of them. So it's a good cast all around.
Cat Williams steals every scene he's in this movie. Like, as soon as he shows up, it's a laugh. He's fantastic. Perfect level of sarcasm. Kiki Palmer's great. Like, the idyllic Drew, who's got aspirations and, like, is really good at her job and just kind of wants to move on and go ahead, but feels kind of pulled back by Alyssa, who is not necessarily that way and is much more, like, just living life as she can do it. Great buddy comedy. Big Super Bad, Booksmart vibes. And it's funny because director Lawrence Lamont, who previously has basically done a lot of music videos and a bit of television, this is his first big directorial feature. He said that he had based this heavily on something like Friday or Super Bad. It's weird. I thought this was like a nostalgia remake. I figured this was just a remake of something that had already come from like the 90s. And it was actually really cool to hop on IMDb, like, oh no, this is totally an original. This is not from something else. This is just kind of inspired by these genre elements of other movies that have come before. And that makes it feel really familiar in a way that's cool, like, and welcoming and comforting. Like, you watch a mid-budget indie comedy like Stuber from a couple years ago, and you're kind of like, okay, it's a guy who drives an Uber and he's driving around Dave Bautista. Yeah, fine. You watch something like this and it's like, oh, I feel like I can connect with what this is doing. Like, this makes sense. And it's such a basic human need. We got to pay the rent by 5. That's it. It's the first. I just got to get rent money. All right. Like, if I can get through today, I'll make it through tomorrow. And I think that's hopeful in a way that a lot of folks just want to sit down and watch a 90-minute comedy can get into. Easy. You can get on your phone for half of it. You can stay tuned in. Not too bad.
I was going to mention that Maud Apatow was in this, daughter of the famous Judd Apatow, has a small role in this as a kind of a gentrifier of the apartment that they're living in. We have a fun series of little plots. They try different schemes to get the rent money. First, they go to a payday loan place where Cat Williams is trying to get people to not go in, and that we get have some fun in games there. They try to donate plasma, and like their phlebotomist it's her first day and she's having a whole lot of trouble finding those veins. That seems really bloody for something kind of gross. But there's a lot of schemes that like they come with that they try to get the shoes that are hanging on a power line to sell. And everything like kind of looks like it's going to work, and then it fails. We also have some subplots of SZA's relationship with her deadbeat boyfriend, who's also cheating on her with this other person who's chasing after them the whole movie in a fun way. And then there's a little bit of a side plot romance between Kiki Palmer's character and a character named Maniac, which is a little thin. It's not very well developed, but it's a fun little element too. So you string enough together enough of these little subplots and comedy bits that like it more or less works.
Yeah, I enjoy the like unmoral fringes that these characters dabble in, right? Like if they need something from another character, rather than ask, like, let's just go steal it while they're not looking. You know what I mean? Like, or they need to give something to somebody and don't have a good way to do it. Well, I'll just stick it in their car when they're not looking. Like this kind of like doing the right thing but going about it the wrong way makes for a lot of good comedy. And Kiki and SZA are a great time between the two of them. I read that their first scene acting together was like when the two of them are arguing late in the movie. And the rest of it just kind of came together from there. Like they play off each other real good. I figured they knew each other like well before they shot the movie, but they seem to just get a lot, like they just have really good chemistry. They get along real well. Like they're funny. They're funny in just the right way. And again, Kiki Palmer does a really good job of bringing her experience where SZA doesn't have it. Like the two of them put out something fantastic here. Probably we'll get a sequel. I was reading it did pretty good at the box office, all things considered, because it was a cheap shoot. Like they could make another one of these things. Like I think people would go see it.
Yeah, for sure. And again, it's in that same vein of things like Friday, and it's gender swapped essentially, because those movies are generally like the last few were Ice Cube and Chris Tucker, and them going on a series of adventures. And so it's nice to kind of see just a swapped version of that with two female leads. One of them days did go on to make $51 million off a $5 million budget, $10 million budget. So. It's done really
yeah,
well.
10 times its money back. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll definitely probably be getting more of, maybe this kind of movie, or again, this is what we've said a lot of, that the Hollywood has to make more money off smaller budgets, because these huge, like these big expensive $70, $80, $100 million movies, they're a huge risk.
Yeah. It's cool, man. Yeah, like I said, it's something smaller, something a bit more intimate. It got stuck in January, like a lot of stuff gets stuck in January, because you don't figure it's going to make awards season and it's not going to make a big splash in the summer and can't compete with the heavy hitters. But slide this thing over on streaming, like let people like us watch it. It's a good time. We saw it on Netflix, and it's worth mentioning, by the way, that you have to have the premium Netflix. You gotta have the premium Netflix tier. You can't, if you're on a low tier, you can't watch it, because that's where we're at now, which is so lame, dude. Remember when everybody used to watch everything on Netflix? So yeah, if you're gonna watch it on Netflix, you're gonna have to make sure you got like the tuned up version, which is so dumb. But that, you know, that's how they're doing.
I remember I did investigate that, because Spider-Verse was the same way, and it's a licensing thing where certain properties, usually newer ones, aren't eligible for ad revenue generation, like you only subscription revenue, not ad revenue. And so that's why it's locked if you have an ad tier version of Netflix.
I kind of get it. I don't know. Anyway, one of them days, it's over on Netflix. You can check it out now. I got to know, Andy, would you recommend one of them days?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a quick 90 minutes. Our leads, SZA and Kiki Palmer, are great. It's a lot of fun. It's silly. It's not too serious. It's the kind of thing that would go over better in a bigger group, probably like a full theater, or you know, you get a few people together to watch on the couch, probably have a little bit better time. But it's a lot of fun. It made good money. We're probably going to see more of these, so I'd recommend.
Yeah, would recommend. Kiki Palmer is great. SZA is great. Director Lawrence Lamont's a good time. Great movie to hang out with. Put on at a party. Watch with your buds. Like, rocks. One of them days is good stuff. Would recommend. And with that, we're going to move on. A little bit of TV coming up on the podcast, which we don't do a lot. If you saw the thumbnail, it says film review. But, you know, every once in a while, we like to step into new spaces. Things are particularly cinematic. And this is something special. This is something different. We talked about it a little bit last week, but Andy's going to be summarizing it briefly before we jump into it. So, Andy, please take it away.
Adolescence. So we talked about this a little bit last week, and we've now, both Zach and I, have seen all four episodes. To remind everyone, in the first episode, we meet a young boy, Jamie, who The police burst into his house and arrest him, and they tell his parents he's being charged with murder. We don't know anything beyond that. There, he's taken to the police station. He's processed. We see all that happening in real time. It's a real-time, one-hour take. The parents slowly get more and more information. They eventually get a solicitor or like a public defender to come and explain what's going on and what they do and don't need to do, and a little bit more about the case. And again, the details are very sparse. We don't really know. And then it turns out someone in the community has been murdered, a young girl that goes to the same school. That's kind of our setup. And then we get four episodes. The second episode follows our detectives at the school, interviewing people at the school, friends, people that knew both the victim and the suspect. The third episode is a one-on-one kind of conversation between Jamie and a psychiatrist. And I don't want to get into the fourth episode, but this has been a very powerful series. That, like, the Prime Minister of England's been talking about this because it brings up a lot of issues about online bullying, social media, how we were raising children, how much you do and don't know about what your children are seeing online or what they're being influenced, and how much responsibility you do and don't have or can and can't have it as a parent. Very powerful series created by Stephen Graham and Jack Thorne. So Zach, what are your thoughts now, having seen all four episodes?
So I think Adolescence is really good. It might even be a great television show. I think the best kind of true crime dramas are the ones that are couching like a really stern lesson or thought on morality or the musings of the world or humanity inside of some kind of case of violence, right, against one another, some kind of transgression. And Adolescence uses its case of violence or transgression like to talk about toxic masculinity and online internet culture, and specifically how that affects children in the age of the internet, at a time when everybody has a screen and nobody can truly monitor what everybody is doing, and no parent can truly always see or respond to how the child is acting. It's a conversation about how our public systems like policing and schooling are not necessarily a fix for this, and really maybe are behind the times and aren't able to keep up with how the internet is teaching kids in a way that parents don't understand, and how it's not always for certain. Also, it's never for sure that a kid is going to be violent because of what they've seen. Some kids come out totally normal. Some kids come out kind of sweet. Some kids might come out accused of something they haven't done. But Adolescence very quickly cuts to the quick of its crime and then moves past it to talk about the larger implications of how a child, how Jamie Miller can get to this place where the police believe he has done this thing and people around him aren't sure that he didn't do it. Some kid who in episode one seems so innocent, right? The first time you see him, he's literally in his bed holding his teddy bear. Like, that's the first time you see the kid. And by the end of episode three, you're scratching your head like, man, I don't know. There's a lot more to this than it seemed on its face, you know? And that's the conversation Adolescence is having, specifically around kids, hence the title. Like, it seems like it would just be a true crime drama on its face. I think it's a lot more. And it's so uniquely presented in its like 45-minute one take format stuff. It's all real one takes. None of those like hidden edits. Netflix has been very braggadocious about this. They did it all in one shot. And that's thanks to DP Matthew Lewis, the director of the show. I'll get his name in a second. He formerly produced a film called Boiling Point with Stephen Graham over in the UK. Did great. They adapted it into a series. It did really great over there as well. Big, long takes. Now, Adolescence is kind of the spiritual successor of that, at least in the way that they shot it. And that's what we have here.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit of things like Mare of Easttown, which is an HBO show where Kate Winslet is also investigating a murder while, you know, dealing with small town politics and issues. And it brings up a lot of social issues while investigating this crime. Adolescence is much less concerned with the crime itself and all the issues it raises about how we raise our sons, and particularly our sons. This is definitely the creator, Jack Thorne, said that this is about male rage. And that's what it's concerned about, because when we first meet Jamie, he's like this thick, thin, like 90-pound boy. And then it seems like everything's grossly inappropriate. Like, why are the SWAT team is here with guns in everyone's faces? Like, what are we doing? And then we learn more and more, and it seems like he very much is capable of having committed this crime, but we don't know for certain. It's a little ambiguous in a lot of ways. We have a lot of interesting characters. We have the police characters, played by Ashley Walters, D.I. Bascom, and his, sergeant. They're working the case. They think they have their prime suspect. They need some more evidence to prove they got to talk to some people. The episode at the school is really interesting because it's just chaotic. Like, they're going from classroom to classroom. They're not getting a lot of great participation. The girl's best friend, they try to talk to her. She doesn't want to talk to anyone. And she's like, why are you talking to me? I didn't kill anyone. Like, screw you. Like, you did, like, and it's just that whole episode is so chaotic. And it highlights the difficulties of the public school system, how it falls short of most students' needs, but it's kind of the best we have. And that's kind of what it says for all of these systems. Like Zach was saying, the police system, the psychiatrist that's involved in this as well. All of this is reactionary, and it kind of shows us how difficult prevention can be in these kind of situations. Like, how do you, monitor everything that your kids are watching? How do you know if they're struggling or dealing with bullying or are being the bullies? It can be very hard to know.
It's pretty incredible how well adolescence is able to hold your attention. And the reason it's able to do that is because of its long take format. Like, it never cuts. We get the whole thing all the way through. It's mostly a cameraman with a Steadicam walking around in front of him. And Matthew Lewis, the director of photography on the show, did a lot of talking about this. Did some reading before the podcast so I could fill you in. None of this was easy. The way they filmed Adolescence was aspiring to film 10 takes of each episode. That was the deal. They had about 5 or 10 shoot days, a couple days of run through and practice. Let's remember Owen Cooper, who plays Jamie Miller in the show. The show's star, 13-year-old, has never acted in anything on film before. First time. So he didn't know any better. And they said that was an advantage. They were like, well, this is just how we're doing it, kid. It's like a stage play. And he was like, all right, cool. You know, just I'll figure it out as I go. Stephen Graham, of course, has done a lot of this. He's fantastic in the show as a father. But shooting every episode, they wanted to aim to do about 10 takes. And Netflix has a great Twitter thread where they talked about which takes they used of those 10, ones that got trashed. I mean, brutally so. They said the second episode in the school was like an absolute nightmare to shoot. There's tons of kids walking around, extras. You got to hide crew members back there because they have to be on to do something. You got to hand off to other camera guys, multiple video villages. There's an incredible drone shot in there that's complicated. Episode 3, meanwhile, is a lot tighter with just a few characters, and you have to shift focus from character to character and keep it interesting and keep your audience engaged. It's a whole lot of work, and I think the reason it works in Adolescence is because they reportedly started with scripts. Reportedly, they didn't intend for this to be a one-er series. It had kind of already started as this 4-episode thing. And then when they brought in Philip Barantini, the show's director, he had talked about, hey, what if we kind of did this? And they started workshopping it and tooling it and figured, well, what if we move this scene over here? What if we put this person down the hall from this person? What if we have the camera walk with them? And before you know it, you have these 4 big, long episodes. No shot lists here. Like, they just did it all together. It's crazy. It's wild that it works as well as it does, and it gets really emotionally affecting by the end, because if you can get into what Adolescence is doing in its presentation, you can fall for it. By 35, 45 minutes into an episode, you're so locked in to what's happening because you have been with these characters the entire runtime. Like, they have gone nowhere else. There have been no cuts. They are acting fully straight through it. And it's really sincere in a way that I didn't expect. It's heartbreaking in moments. It's tense. It's action-packed. Like, it's something else. There's some real energy in Netflix's Adolescence. And Netflix puts out a lot of content every year, but this is one of those ones that's like, oh boy, this is worth telling your friends about.
Yeah, I haven't watched a ton of TV stuff this year, but it's nice to have a surprise like this. And I feel like that's usually how the best media finds you. It's not the stuff that you're super hyped about. It's like something that you heard a little bit about. Like, I had heard this mentioned on a couple of podcasts, and then a friend of mine saw it and really recommended it to me. And I was blown away from the first episode. The first episode is all you need to get hooked on it, I think. And the rest of the episodes are excellent as well. I've also heard that particularly if you're a parent, I've heard it can be really affected. And even though I'm not, I thought it was still very, very engaging and captivating.
Yeah, same. First episode shot out of a cannon. Like, I would absolutely recommend you at least check it out if you're at all interested. It's like 48 minutes. It's not that long. It's really incredible. And it's a really great, like, premiere of what's to come, while also reminding you there's only four of these things. It's only four episodes. That's it. Like, you could technically watch them all in one day if you wanted. Like, no problem. You could watch them all in an evening if you wanted. Wouldn't recommend it. They're pretty heavy, but it's good stuff. Like, it's really cool. Adolescence is a really rad show. So I got to know, Andy, would you recommend Adolescence?
Yeah, absolutely would. Like I said, it was a big surprise. It's a heavy subject matter. You know, it deals with the death of a minor and the person who's accused of the murder, and deals with a lot of tough subjects about adolescence, about raising kids, about social media, about the communities we live in and the things we do and don't know about our kids. Incredible performances, particularly by Stephen Graham, who plays the father in the show, and also Owen Cooper as Jamie. Incredible technical display by everything being one shot. So highly recommend.
Same. Adolescence is really cool. There are only so many shows you can watch in a year for four episodes. Like, for the time investment required to get all the way through it, it's a no-brainer. Check it out. It's on Netflix right now. You don't have to have a premium account to watch it. I think you could watch it on anything. I do think this will get some Emmys attention later this year for limited series or miniseries. Like, keep an eye on it. Keep an eye on this space because I think Adolescence is doing something really special. Really cool show. Available on Netflix now. We got to talk about some upcoming trailers, Andy. What do we call this segment?
It's time for the trailer park. We have a bunch of trailers this week, starting off with Megan 2.0. Again, we were talking about CinemaCon was last week, and a bunch of announcements were made, and we also saw some more trailers. So, Zach, tell us about Megan.
Man, I was not big on the first Megan until we saw it, and I realized, okay, I see what this is doing. At first, it just seemed like a goofy Blumhouse picture, but the original Megan film was about an AI robot who comes to life, and at first becomes a young girl's friend until ultimately it kind of goes rogue and starts murdering people. Bit Child's Play, right? Bit Chucky. That was kind of the angle, but fun and sarcastic in a way that I think people got into. It was a vibe, right? She dances down a hall. It's a whole thing. Well, Megan 2.0 picks up the story 2 years later, when a rogue military AI has taken over what I think is a military base of some sort, according to the IMDb's description. And in order to combat this thing, our creator of Megan returns from the previous film, along with her daughter, to revive the rogue AI, Megan, from the first film, put her in another stronger body, and send her to the base to fight this thing. It's robot versus robot, and Megan is now playing Arnold from Terminator 2, Judgment Day. She's one of the good guys. And, like, tragically, great bit, dude. I'm more excited to see this movie than I was to see the first one. Like, that's great. That's exactly what you want, right? The cool robot from the first movie that was bad, now it's good. It's a good guy robot. Like, can't wait. Rocks. Great plot. I wish more robot movies did this. What do you think of the Megan 2.0 trailer?
I'm excited for this too. It's just, it's so much camp and it looks so fun. That was part of the appeal of the first one. People got on board with, like, Megan had these great outfits and she would have these quips and she was kind of sassy. And so all that is turned up to 11. And in the sequel, she's got, again, cool new outfits. At first, she's kind of stuck in, like, an Alexa-style device, and they're like, we have to reprogram you, just like Terminator 2, to then be the hero. And it's like, it's slay versus slay. Like, the trailer is great because it's like that bee versus this bee. Like, it's really great stuff. And again, it's one of these cheap Blumhouse things that everyone loves. I think it's going to be a big hit, a lot of fun.
Yeah, big pro Megan 2.0. What's next, Andy?
Tron Ares. So this actually just came out over the weekend. Tron Ares is the third installment in the Tron series. Its previous installment was almost 15 years ago, Tron Legacy. The series is a little bit Matrix-like, or rather the Matrix was a little Tron-like, where a kid gets sucked into a computer and has to do these rad, like, motorcycle scenes. And the effects look really good. In this, it seems like our digital world and real world have crossed over. over. It starts off with these really cool looking light cycles that they throw this beam of light and slice a cop car in half. Looks really awesome. There's some giant something or other taking over the city, and we see Greta Lee in here of Past Lives fame. This trailer's all vibes. We get zero story. It just like it looks super cool. You got this giant robot looking like it's taking over the city, light cycles, light planes, people being built up digitally, and then we're disappointed by Jared Leto as the star at the very end of the movie. Morbius himself is the lead in this, apparently. This looks super cool. I'm sold just on the look, on the vibes alone. I'm there. This is coming out in October, right near my birthday, so I will be there.
Yeah, if there's two things Tron is known for doing well, at least in its later iteration, Tron Legacy, which came out in, 2009, it's A, having great music with the soundtrack from Daft Punk, rest in peace, and B, great visuals. Let's remember the previous film was directed by Joseph Kosinski, who would go on to do Top Gun Maverick, and is now working on F1, which is coming to theaters this July. So, big visuals, big music, right? Tron Ares in this trailer gives us two of those things. We get big visuals. These big red digital things are breaking into the real world. They are chopping cop cars in half. They got slow-mo light cycles. The giant ship things are in there. It looks rad. We don't know a lot about what's going on other than these things are coming into the real world crazy. And B, the music. It's not Daft Punk, but it's Nine Inch Nails, which is really Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, but they talked about this in an interview. They wanted to explicitly run it under the Nine Inch Nails label because unlike their soundtrack work with directors like Luca Guadagnino, this is grittier and this is more garage and they wanted to have more synth and they wanted to really line it up with more of the sound of the band, which is not something they do in the traditional film soundtrack. So they were like, no, this is going to be similar to kind of what we've done before. We wanted to have a vibe like the Daft Punk soundtrack. That's all good. That all checks out. The worst part of this is Jared Leto. Every tweet I've seen about this is like, man, this movie's great. I hope Jared Leto isn't in it a lot. You know, like they reveal him at the end. I thought it was a crazy pick to put him in here, you know, and it still feels like a crazy pick. I don't know how involved he's going to be, but Tron Ares, baby, like coming eventually, I guess. That's do you actually know what's coming out this summer? Next summer?
October 10th.
October? All right. Going to be a Halloween joint. Get your Tron Ares fits at your local Spirit Halloween store.
Yeah, it's interesting. Again, we were talking about millennial content. The 2009 version, Garrett Hedlund and Olivia Wilde are kind of our leads in that movie. And I guess it's still, again, it's sticking more with that older millennial generation because it was like, why wouldn't you get anyone younger? Like both your leads are over 40. So, and I mean, like Jared Leto's in his 50s now. So again, it looks like a movie for teens, but you got old people in there like myself. So again, it's like, who are we catering to here?
I'll tell you, if old people need to see a movie, I can tell you exactly what movie they should be going to see. It's The Phoenician Scheme. The new Wes Anderson trailer is out. That's right. Your little cutesy models and symmetry and vanilla color palettes, they're all back in The Phoenician Scheme. Wes Anderson's new film, produced under Indian Paintbrush, just like every other film he's ever done, stars a cavalcade of Wes Anderson favorites. Let me read off a couple of these. Benicio Del Toro, Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Bryan Cranston, Benedict Cumberbatch, Richard Ayoade, Rupert Friend, Michael Cera, Jeffrey Wright, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Riz Ahmed. Like, insane. Every Wes Anderson movie has like the incredible cast and everybody takes like studio minimum for it because they just like doing them. Phoenician Scheme is of course a period piece about a very successful businessman played by Del Toro who appears to fake his death, I think, and ultimately decides to leave parts of his business to his very large family with multiple children. It seems to go kind of awry. There seem to be some shenanigans afoot, some kind of military complex involved. The Phoenician Scheme, don't know a lot about it, but sure looks like vibes. Andy, what do you think?
I'm generally not a huge Wes Anderson fan. His style doesn't really do much for me, but I really liked the look of this trailer. It looked funny. It's got a huge cast. I'm going to read off some of these names here. Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Bryan Cranston, Benedict Cumberbatch, Benicio Del Toro, Rupert Friend, Michael Cera, Jeffrey Wright, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Riz Ahmed, Hope Davis, Jason. I mean, it just goes on and on. this just, it kind of hit me different. It looked a little bit more fun, a little bit more entertaining. And I think I'm more on board with it than his past two films, which were The French Dispatch and Asteroid City. So I'm looking forward to this a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm skeptical, I think, like always, but I always seem to enjoy what he does. I still, being more of a fan, I think, of Wes Anderson than I've been in my previous kind of film enjoyment career. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I've been a fan later in life. Like earlier, I was not into him. When I was in school, I did not like Wes Anderson at all. So I've kind of come around on him. But his whole gimmick of using miniatures and cutesy models and all this stuff, like to kind of lure you in and lower your defenses for wacky comedy and ultimately like heartfelt emotion is affecting on me. And I hope it grows to bigger audiences. Like, finish this game, we'll see. I look solid. I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited. I'm definitely going to go see this in theaters. One more to talk about, Andy. We teased this one at the top. What is this movie?
So we got a second trailer to Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, which comes out in about 6-7 weeks from now over the Memorial Day holiday. Not similar to Tron. We didn't really get a lot of plot, more vibes, but the vibes are immaculate. We got planes. We got Tom Cruise hanging off of a plane. We got submarines. We got car crashes. We got fistfights. We got references to all like 7 or 8 Mission Impossible films. We got old characters from the original 1996 version. Lots of things sprinkled throughout. It looks like a lot of fun, and it just looks a little bit more like they've upped the ante from the first film. It's got really cool music. I was so on board. It's hard to describe because you just got to see all these different action scenes. It looks great. We have the addition of some more smaller actors, Trimal Tillman from Severance, Nick Offerman, Katie O'Brien's going to be in there, Hannah Waddingham. So they've upped the cast as well. And it just looks so exciting.
Yeah, I had seen the original trailer for Mission Impossible Final Reckoning, thought it looked fine. Like I said at the top of the show, I'm not as into this as Andy is. I am a little bit kind of lost with what happened in the last few Mission Impossible movies, but I get the general impressions. I think, like most audiences, Ethan Hunt is our secret agent. He's on the run. Something has gone wrong. He's going to get caught unless he does the thing at the last possible second. It's an impossible mission, right? For what it's worth, the Mission Impossible Final Reckoning trailer rips, dude. This trailer is awesome. I cannot believe how many shots are in here. If I ran this through scene edit detection, it would pull a million out of it. The music rocks. Like, they are putting it all on the line. They're leaving it all on the field, which is exactly what I think they're supposed to be doing. If this is reportedly supposed to be the last Mission Impossible, for a minute at least, I'm sure, then yeah, you want to put in everything you can. The Avengers of Mission Impossible movies is exactly what I think they're going for here. So hopefully it's good, man. Like, I'm looking forward to it. I want to get a popcorn. I want to get in the D-Box rocketed through the screen. I want my chair to eject me out through the ceiling as soon as big stuff happens. It looks like a great time. One more movie. Well, go ahead.
Well, I said, where would you recommend people to start?
But oh gosh!
If they were to watch one Mission Impossible movie, where would you start before?
Dude, I don't know.
The one that comes before.
I would probably say the first one. Where would you start? The first one's older cinematically for sure, but it's still got some great sequences, dude. The first one's got some great stuff.
I would probably start later because, like I said, the first three are kind of a different era of filmmaking, and yeah. they play as a good like trilogy. I would start maybe 6 is so good. That's one with Henry Cavill's in it. Like some really incredible action scenes in there. It's probably one of the best modern action films of all time. My personal favorite is 4, Ghost Protocol, which also again, star Simon Pegg, directed by Brad Bird, who directed The Incredibles. And it has a little bit of that, like, we got to work together as a team and a family. Yeah. But you can almost pick anywhere, either the older genre or in the newer 4 through 6 to start. Don't feel like you have to watch all 7.
Which one is the one where they blow up the Kremlin?
4.
I've got a really vivid memory of all the Mission Impossible movies at a party at college after everybody had taken off of staying up real late and getting fried watching Mission Impossible 4. And let me tell you, I didn't remember a whole lot from that movie plot-wise, but the vibes were immaculate. Him outrunning the Kremlin was nuts. Maybe that's the one to start with. I don't know. I need to read this.
Yeah, I like that one a lot.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. I distinctly remember thinking this movie's amazing, like, for what it's worth. So yeah, I maybe could stand to revisit them. Final Reckoning looks like it rocks. We got one more movie to talk about on the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to talking about this one. We kind of missed this last year. This is one of these smaller A24 indie comedies that came out late that we just didn't catch. Didn't seem like it had that much heat. A little like Death of a Unicorn, actually, that we covered last week. So I'm looking forward to covering this one. I'm going to be taking the summary, so please excuse my clumsy delivery. The movie is Y2K. So Eli and Danny, two absolute losers in high school, are so desperate to get any action from any women in their lives. Eli is crazy about Laura, played by Rachel Ziegler, who's in his Spanish class. She's on the yearbook team. She's awesome. She's funny. But Eli, played by Jaden Martell, is a loser. And his friend Danny, played by Julian Dennison from Deadpool 2, is a loser, right? But the two of them decide to go to this house party. They're finally going to do it. It's New Year's. They got the perfect excuse that for Eli to maybe plan a kiss on Laura right at midnight, right? They go, the clock strikes midnight, the lights go out, and every device in the house comes alive like some kind of freak ET short circuit robot and starts slaying teens all over the place. The whole town goes haywire, the kids run outside, and we have Y2K, the film from director Kyle Mooney. Now, Kyle is a writer on SNL. He's done a lot of comedy in the past. He's got a lot of YouTube bits out there. He put out a comedy album this year. I don't see any directing credits for him on IMDb. When you click on him as a director, it takes you to his page, and there's no directing credits listed. So I'm assuming this is the only thing he's directed. And it's, you know, it's a freshman directorial feature, let's say. That it's something else, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. Andy, what do you think of Y2K?
So we were talking about earlier with the Minecraft movie about how it's kind of the dawn of maybe a new younger age of filmmaking where we're not going to cater to millennials, we're going to cater to Gen Z and after. And Y2K feels like the death knell of millennial content because this is, it's strangely like a teen sex comedy in the vein of something like Can't Hardly Wait or Superbad or Booksmart, where like the nerd losers have to go to the high school party and get the girl, a trope that we've seen done a lot. The problem is all the humor is definitely millennial targeted because it's 1999. So all the jokes are about 1999 and 2000. But again, it's aimed at like 18 to 24 year olds. So if you get all the humor, you're too old for the movie. And if you're the right age for the movie, you're not going to get any of the humor. So it's kind of, it doesn't work. It's kind of bad. And it's kind of real boring. I feel bad for Rachel Zegler because it's her first like kind of non-singing role. Yeah. Most everything requires her to sing. And she's fine. But man, it's just, it's not very good. The first 30 minutes is like the setup of any teen comedy you've ever seen in your whole life. Here are the losers, here are the cool kids, here are the other groups. It doesn't turn into this horror movie until like act two, and there's zero setup for it. Like the movie could go in 100 directions because there's no setup of like, hey, this Y2K thing's going to happen and all these robots are going to turn evil and start killing people. Like there's zero setup. It just takes a sharp turn in the second act. And then is a series of mostly not funny bits. I laugh like twice at this. Yeah. At one of the jokes I can't repeat, but it's not funny. And it's just so out of touch. It's just like, it's like me trying to write a teen comedy, you know, 25 years too late.
Yeah, I can't put my finger on what this is trying to be, because if it's trying to be like a modern, almost like Adult Swim midnight movie, or like a sketchy kind of thing, like Tim Robbins, I Think You Should Leave, or like a Tim Heidecker sketch, who appears in this movie, by the way, he's got a bit part as a pretty funny character, Eli's father, kind of a loser. Then I kind of get it, but the advantage of those sketches is they're all like 4 minutes and then they end and you jump to the next thing. And Y2K is wildly, deadly unserious. Nothing is taken serious in this movie. Like a character can get a limb lopped off and they'll be hopping around like the Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. You know what I mean? Like nothing is serious in the world of Y2K. So the stakes aren't that high. And much like one of those like sketches or an Adult Swim bit, like those end pretty quick and you move to the next thing. But Y2K has this problem where it gets all the goods out in like the first act. And then it's got 60 minutes to go. And it's like, what are we going to do for the rest of this movie? And there's some good. There's some good stuff for being a gag a minute feature. Every once in a while, you're going to hit a good gag. I got more than two laughs, admittedly. I got a couple good laughs out of this movie. I do also want to mention good costuming. The cast is good. I think Ziegler's probably the best of all of them. Jaden Martell's fine. But the other good thing is needle drops. Ton of good music in here. I don't know who was fixing up the soundtrack, but like incredible number of 90s needle drops that are bangers in here. So for what it's worth, if you're a 90s music head, Y2K is great. Like, great soundtrack on Spotify, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's part of what works. Like I said, it's filled with millennial humor, Tybo, dial-up internet. Although some of it's kind of anachronistic because a lot of that chat room culture didn't start until like the early 2000s, and this is taking place in 99. And some of the chatting, like LOL or LMAO, I was like, none of that actually wasn't around.
Yeah,
like then, you didn't do your research.
Yeah, those are those are the moments I was trying to figure out if Y2K is being self-referent. Like, does it know that it's not serious that way? Is it making a joke on purpose? Like, or is it being like intentional? Like, oh, this is how 90s kids kind of spoke. In the same way that they put like David Bowie music in like the Heath Ledger movie in Night's Tale. It doesn't fit, but it's like, well, it's like a vibe. Like the vibe is like LOL, so it's fine. I don't know. Like, whatever it's doing, it's not made clear and it doesn't land. Like, that's the problem. Like, I think there's probably, I don't know. I think Mooney's real creative and I like a lot of the work that he's done. But on a long 90-minute timeline, it's hard to hold that same tone of energy throughout the whole thing. You know what I mean? Like, to have the same kind of laugh and the same kind of joke. There's a whole B-plot in here with a couple of stoner characters that is so god-awful that should have absolutely been cut out of this movie, that is boring every second they are on screen and you don't care about them at all. And they're not even really introduced until about 25 minutes into the movie. But if you cut it, it wouldn't even be feature length. Like, it's got to be in there and make it the full runtime for it to go to theaters and be distributed by A24. Like, so that's not good. Like, that doesn't work that good. Our A plot between like Jaden Martell and Rachel Ziegler, solid. I mean, she is so obviously out of his league and he's pining after her. And there's this other kid, Soccer Chris, they call him, played by Kid Leroy of all people, who's, you know, much more popular and into her. But then when things go topsy turvy at this party, like suddenly things have changed. The dynamic is different. We're on the run and oh God, we just got to get out of here. And I just want to go to high school next week. You know, now I got to deal with the world falling apart. It would be, I think, a little bit funnier if it took itself more serious, almost like, I guess I was hoping for something like Shaun of the Dead, right? Where you have like this group of losers who like everything goes wrong in society and they still have to like figure out how to get by, but it doesn't really end up being that. It ends up feeling like a lesser Stranger Things kind of movie where it's like very period and we're trying to just kind of like hop on our bikes and ride through town and hopefully we'll find, you know, our parents are figuring out a way to stop this thing. Oh, look at it. We found that there's a thing going on at the high school gymnasium. It's almost like a Disney Channel original movie. Like it's, but I can't tell if it knows that or not. I can't figure out who the joke is on exactly. I guess the joke's on me.
Yeah. I want to talk about cast a little bit. Everyone is too old to be in this movie. Like you run into that problem where like these people are not convincing teenagers. Eduardo Franco, who you've probably seen in a lot of things, he's got very long, distinctly long hair. He's 30 and it's like, he's been playing a teenager for 15 years. Same thing with Mason Gooding is in this, who's in the Scream movies and who's like, he was in Booksmart, which is a 20 teens comedy. It's just like, y'all are all too old. None of you look like seniors. You all look like college students. Same thing with Julian Dennison is in his 20s. And this happens a lot. And sometimes people can convincingly play teenagers, but it's not super convincing. I think Rachel Ziegler kind of pulls it off. She manages to style her hair and look younger than she is. Everyone else is like I said, Eduardo Franco's 30. I couldn't believe that when I just looked it up.
Ziegler works because she's not a loser. Like, so she's playing a character who's distinctly like has aspirations and is going somewhere and has herself put together and like gets along with her friends and goes to parties. But ultimately, like, she is the character that the losers are pining for. So our loser characters are like sad and you know, dumb. And meanwhile, she's like funny and interesting. And like, she gets that grace for sure. I read that originally it was supposed to be Jenna Ortega in her role. Ortega couldn't do it for scheduling. It would be funny if she was shooting Death of a Unicorn, because again, that feels a lot like this, like just an A24 mm-hmm. comedy that's like fine. It's fine, right? But like, I think it'll have its people. It does feel a bit like a midnight movie kind of thing, especially with a big guest star at the end, dude. I didn't expect famous musician, semi-famous musician from the 90s, I suppose, who ends up being a lot of fun. He's a good time. Surprise third act appearance, but otherwise, I don't know. It just kind of ends up lacking. I kind of wish I'd seen it in theaters. I think it would have been a little warmer. Maybe something like Bodies, Bodies, Bodies would be a better comparison, you know, to what this movie's doing, but it just kind of misses. And I can't help but feel like it's because of it's Mooney's first directorial feature, right? He's got to get all these kids together. Well, mostly kids, and God, get the sets and get it all worked out. Like it's a ton, dude. I can't do it all, like, for sure. I'm thinking that's where the brunt of the problems come from, because the writing feels okay and the acting feels okay and the sets feel good and the music's good.
Yeah, these teen stoner comedies, coming of age stories, tend to do better when they're set in contemporary time. Again, Can't Hardly Wait, it is a 1998 movie, which is in the late 90s. Superbad, of course, famously in the late 2000s. Booksmart, which is one of my favorite comedies of the last decade or so, in the late 20-teens. And they're all taking place in contemporary America, and they work so much better because of that. If you're going to do a period piece, it's got to be maybe a little bit more serious, or you can't do this kind of parody thing that they're going for.
Right.
It just doesn't quite work.
Yeah, or it's got to be like the Adult Swim ultra stylized gag, like Paul Rudd in the green screen space kind of stuff, typing in a computer, like, which I don't know if you could carry for 90 minutes. Like, it tries to walk this line in the middle. It's trying to be American Pie and also Superbad. Like, I don't know. I don't know. Didn't do it for me, I guess. But I think there'll be people out there who are into it. Also, we just got through this whole episode. I just realized the title card at the top of the whole thing says Death of a Unicorn and Queer, and that's definitely supposed to say Y2K and one of them days. I'll fix that later. Anyway, we got to get to final recommendations. Andy, would you recommend Y2K?
I'm going to say pass on this. I was really pretty bored through this, and it's not very long. The jokes aren't really funny. It's super dated, and I can't tell if the humor is for millennials or for Gen Z laughing at millennials. It doesn't hit the way, like, you know, a nostalgic 80s movie does. Our cast is fine. Rachel Zegler and Jade Martell is our lead. But everyone's too old. No one looks like a teenager. No one really knows how to act like a teenager. The jokes are mostly missed. There's a few laughs here and there, but yeah, was really bored doing this. So I would say pass.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat. Skip it. We watched it on HBO. If you got the time and you want to throw on something late at night, like, throw it on. It's not bad. There's some good jokes in there. There were a couple I laughed at, but it's for a 90-minute movie. Like, a couple didn't gonna quite do it. You're gonna need a little bit more than that. But if you're a Kyle Mooney fan, I think check it out. Like I said, I know he's got an album out. People have been laughing about what that is, whether or not that's a legitimate effort. Like, my man's. I don't want to say divisive. He's doing new stuff in the space. And having Tim Heidecker in the cast is obviously a ringing endorsement of its ability. I think he's a really funny guy. I think Y2K needs a little bit of tune-up. Whatever he does next, I'll probably check it out, though, because I think he learned an awful lot making this thing. So, and he's in it. Shoot, I forgot. He plays a guest role in it. That is episode 289 of Off-Script Film Review, Andy. My God. Next week, funny kind of scheduling thing going on. Why don't you tell the folks what's up, Andy?
Yeah, we're going to be taking the week off. It's not a ton out, both in theaters and on streaming. So we will be back on Wednesday, April 22nd with Warfare, which is a new A24 war film that takes place in Afghanistan, I believe. And then also Sinners, which comes out April 18th, that we're really excited about. Sorry, Michael B. Jordan and Hailee Steinfeld. And I'm going to be taking a look at The Last of Us Season 2, which premieres this Sunday. So actually, I'll get two episodes in of that, and then we'll be back. Zach, famously not a fan, because he's played the game, not a fan of the Last of Us TV show.
Yeah, I have a complicated relationship with the video game. The video game goes some funny places. The show does too, I'm sure. It's quite emotional, and yeah, dude, the Last of Us video game was genuinely changed the way I think about video games. Cinematic in a way that, like, I didn't think video games could be. Like, emotional in a way that I didn't understand. It's a whole thing. I'll get around to watching it eventually. It's fine. Anyway, if you like the show today, Off Script Film Review episode 289, or any of our previous episodes, best way you can support us is to subscribe to the channel. YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, iHeart, wherever you're at, we're around. throw a sub at us, huh? Maybe get a recommendation next week. Maybe throw a like on a video, a comment, a notification bell ring. Whatever you do, whatever works for you, we're excited to be a part of it. So thanks for checking us out. You can find us in all the usual audio places, Spotify, iHeartMedia, iTunes, Google Play, Amazon. You can find our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, at Offscript Film Review, at Offscript Review. You know, we're on YouTube. Big things going on the YouTube channel. Can check us out over there. Our website, offscriptfilmreview.com, is available as well for additional resources. And you can email us correspondence directly from you to us, fan to podcaster, at offscriptfilmreview.com. Or like DM us. I don't know. You can always just come find us on social media. We're around. All right. Not exactly impossible to get a hold of. Someday, when this show's big, you're going to miss when you could just hit us up right away. You're going to regret the days you didn't phone in and tell us what's going on or write us an email. So thanks for checking in, and thanks for listening to the show. Next week off, and that's the episode, Offscript episode 289, from all of us at Offscript, the home of bold cinema. I'm Zach Lewis.
And I'm Dr. Draper.
Thanks for watching.